The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order Higher Education Finance and Policy. We're going to pick up where we left off last Wednesday with Minsky, and I think we've got the Vice Chancellor, System Director of Research, and System Director for Financial Planning. We were discussing bonuses and salaries at the time and criteria for bonuses, so if the individuals would again please identify yourself for the committee and welcome to the committee, and we'll begin with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Laura King. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance and the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. With me is Craig Schoenecker, who you met last week. Craig is the System Director for Research. And joining us today is Susan Anderson, who's the System Director for Financial Planning. I asked Susan to join us in the event we proceed to the allocation framework discussion, since she is the chief architect and caretaker of that process.
Vice Chancellor, there were questions at the end about the bonuses and the criteria for the bonuses of the administrators. And I don't know if members had any more questions dealing with salaries, but can you tell the committee what you're going to do about the bonuses and the criteria for those bonuses?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. We've been keeping a list of follow-up items that have come out of these discussions, and that list currently is in the low dozen, as I recall. And from our discussion last week, we added the exchange around criteria to that list, and we expect to have a package for you tomorrow that will have all of the answers to the questions that have arisen to date. And we will include in that package the criteria that are used as part of the presidential performance evaluation process.
And Vice Chancellor, I believe I raised the question of whether or not there was a administrator that was under a vote of no confidence and still received a bonus during this six-year time period. Do you have an answer to that question?
Mr. Chair, we will have an answer tomorrow as part of the package.
All right. Representative Swinton.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just, you know, we kind of touched on the bonuses and looking at it from a performance base and how they're calculated. You know, from a success standpoint, do you feel that, you know, Rosenstone has said that he's planning on maybe getting rid of them, but from an administrative standpoint, the drivers of some of those things, the reason why they exist, has there been an analysis done? Has it driven some success? Has it moved things forward? Has it, you know, from that standpoint, other than that they exist, and yay, maybe they should exist or not, have they produced anything of value?
Vice Chancellor King. Know.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the administrative performance relationship is part of a larger professional development and performance development program that includes a regular evaluation process with the presidents. The presidents all undertake annual planning. That planning's reviewed with the chancellor. It ties in with the strategic framework and the goals that come from a legislative or other direction. So we work with presidents every year towards those goals. If you're asking me, could I say that the presence of this merit program is uniquely responsible for performance that we wouldn't otherwise see? The research on that question in the HR world is as varied as the strategies are. There is research that suggests both answers. So I'm not able to say that we have a definitive conclusion.
That's it. I'll ask a broader question. In the macro view, considering the last 8 years of the historic cuts to higher ed, the historic tuition increases, and what we're going to look at now is historic debt, how successful have those bonuses been? You don't have to answer. We'll get to it tomorrow, but I think that question needs to be answered too. Those things that happened were real, and as those things occurred, bonuses were given to the architects of those budgets. So let's proceed. Where do you want to start today, Vice Chancellor?
Mr. Chair, then, with your introduction, I will start us on tab 10. I'd like to begin a discussion on student debt. We had some discussion about this last week, but I'd like to spend a little bit of time on it today as well. What you see in your materials, both in the binder and in the package of slides today, is a little thing we'd like to stop and talk about concerning the difference between median and mean, and right. How.
Vice Chancellor, let's just draw everyone's attention. This is off the insert, not directly off what's in the booklet.
That's correct.
So members should go to the insert dated February 25th, 2013. For the stick figures?
Correct.
You familiar with the Sherlock Holmes story that had stick figures?
Mr. Chair, I am not.
It's unfortunate. All right, proceed.
It seemed important to us to pause and examine the difference between mean and median as we enter into the student debt discussion. This chart shows 11 students with various levels of debt. The U.S. Department of Education standard for reporting graduate debt disclosures is to rely on the median of debt for all graduates. When you do that, you see some pretty strong differences. What you see in the next slide illustrates where the median debt is in this array of students. The average would move this up by several thousand dollars. The median debt for all students shown here is $11,639. Five students have more debt and five have less. The mean, on the other hand, would be $13,886. If we look just at the median of only those with debt, we'd see a number of $14,200, whereas the mean of only those with debt would be $16,900. We rely on the Department of Education standard when we will talk with you in the upcoming slides about student debt, which in turn is a measure of median, either median of only those with debt or median of those of all students counting the debt. Before we get to the most recent numbers and trends for MNSCU, it's important for us to note that our debt numbers are very different from those for private not-for-profit schools and the debt numbers of for-profits. Using the latest available data, baccalaureate recipients from Minnesota's public four-year universities have less debt than their counterparts graduating from private not-for-profit colleges and substantially less debt than students graduating from private for-profit colleges. What these bars show you is that public four-year students at the baccalaureate level, 23% of the graduates have no debt, and 83% of the graduates have debt less than $30,000 at the completion of their degree work. That contrasts with 73% for the private not-for-profits and only 19% for the private for-profits. So we feel it's very important that as we have this student debt conversation, we recognize that it's behaving differently in different sectors of the higher education industry.
Vice Chancellor, this data is 2007 to 08. There would be another 4 years of tuition increases, so it's likely that these numbers would change somewhat.
Mr. Chair, we do not have available national data that would enable us to update this chart, but we do have some more current data on the following slides.
Vice Chancellor, is this the material you gave to the Office of Higher Education? Did you submit material to them for? We're going to get a report from them on exactly the same type of cross section. So, Mr. Schoenecker?
Chair Pawlowski, we did submit some data to them. They've asked us to revise that data, and we will be providing that in the near future.
All right. That we are getting a report once we're done with the two systems on student debt, and then we'll go over the budget requests of the two systems. So, all right, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another way to look at this is to look just particularly at MNSCU graduates. Using, again, the latest comparative data that we have, you will see on this slide that one-third of our graduates graduate with no debt compared to just 1% of those who graduate from for-profit institutions. The median debt for our graduates is $7,480, contrasting with a number three times that size for the private for-profit institutions. this illustrates, I think, really, really sharply how important it is to understand that debt is behaving differently in different sectors. And so we appreciate you allowing us an opportunity to present it. That being said, it is certainly the case that median debt levels have been rising much faster than tuition. Recalling the slide we looked at last week that showed that our tuition and fees have held constant as a percentage of personal income, what this chart shows us then is something else is going on that's driving additional debt beyond what's happening with our tuition and fees. You can see that certainly the increase has been steady since the middle of the decade, and that it certainly has some relationship to what's going on in the economy. It's also the case that we're serving more families from low and modest incomes, but something else is happening that's driving debt increases, because it is going up much faster than our tuition's been going up. And our tuition as a percentage of personal income has been very steady for the last 7 or 8 years. Noting that the debt for Minsky graduates in fiscal 12 terms, this is the most recent data we have just for our graduates. And you can see again, compared to our counterparts, more of our students graduate with no debt, and they graduate with less debt. 47% of our certificate and diploma recipients, 34% of our associate degree recipients, and 27% of our baccalaureate degree recipients graduate with no debt. You can note on the chart there, the median for all graduates at the baccalaureate level is $18,000. The median for associate degrees is $8,500, and the median for certificate and diplomas is $2,700, recognizing that fully half of our certificate and diploma graduates graduate without any debt at all. Leaving the debt question then, if I might, Mr. Chair, and moving into differential tuition, a question that came to us from your communication asked us to speak particularly to differential tuition, and so we've included a slide here. Differential tuition refers to a provision in our board policy that allows, with board approval, for colleges and universities to establish a tuition rate on a particular course or program that's different from the standard undergraduate or graduate per credit rate. And it's allowed in policy in order to recognize particular costs of instruction that exceed the average, high specialized equipment requirements, high material requirements, things like truck driving training, large mechanical training, our law enforcement programs, which use a lot of equipment in there, that consume a lot of equipment. All of those provisions are approved in policy and in total represent less than 6% of our total tuition revenue. Similarly, in looking at fees as a portion of our tuition.
Let's go back to that one for a second. I'm looking at my outline that I gave to you at the beginning of the session. And in the second group, I had differential tuition by program with actual costs. Now, I don't see a programmatic breakdown here. I see a generic percentage. So what programs exactly do you have differential tuition for? And is it in the packet? Can you point us to it?
Mr. Chair, if your members would turn to tab 9, you will find, starting on page 9-5 and running through page 9-148, a listing by college over the course of 6 years of differential tuition rates by course or program. You asked us for 6 years, and so you have here 6 years by college at either the college level or the university level.
Vice Chancellor King, can you point to the highest of the differential tuition in this chart?
Mr. Chair, offhand, I cannot.
When did you start using differential tuition? When did that come into play?
Mr. Chair, I recall it being in policy as long as I've been with the organization. We have changed the policy about 5 years ago. We changed the policy to substantially narrow the availability of it as a tuition feature, but I recall it being around as long as I've been around. I can verify that for you.
Would it be appropriate to say that the more expensive programs like nursing would have a higher differential tuition than a two-year program like automotive mechanics?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that to be the case.
Does anyone know it at the group at the table?
We can look into it, but not on the spot, no.
All right, for our next meeting, let's have an answer to that question. My concern is that nursing and engineering and other programs are already expensive for the campuses to allow. And it appears, and we can substantiate it or not, that differential tuition has been used there greater than anywhere else. But I'd like numbers to prove it. And if they don't, then that's fine too.
Mr. Chair, one of the difficulties we have in assembling any kind of longitudinal data on differential tuition is that in some cases it's at the course level, and in some cases it's at the program level. And so we don't get perfect matches of data, but we will do what we can to examine your question.
Vice Chancellor, I'm sympathetic with it, but the students pay it regardless of
That's
how
correct.
You can identify it. And I am concerned about how selected programs, or as you're saying, courses, are identified in some way with differential tuition. My other concern is, if you particularly have a course, let's take the example of nursing, where you may have a pool of students beyond, you can use differential tuition to increase the tuition of that particular program, of course, and that then becomes a cash cow. It doesn't necessarily go into the program, but it does go to the campus or to the system. That's my concern.
Mr. Chair, board policy would not allow that.
Well, then you can show us that at the next meeting.
Mr. Chair, in the materials, you'll find the board policy.
And we'll go through it, but I'm requesting at the next meeting that we take a look at the highest of the differential tuitions and where they are. So, okay, proceed.
Similarly, you'll note that in response to a question about fees and what's gone on with fees in the organization over the last 6 years, you'll see from this slide that at the college level, fees represent a small and slightly declining share of total student costs. Colleges represent 10% of the total tuition and fee charge, whereas universities represent 7.5% of the total tuition and fee charge. In your binder, you'll find the board policy on fees. You'll find the fees that are charged, and you'll find 6 years worth of information about the fee rates by fee type for each college and university. Students are highly involved in fee-setting decisions through consultation with campus leadership, and they have decision-making authority on the fees for the student associations. Turning now to a conversation about the allocation framework, and you'll find this in tab 7. The allocation framework is the label we use to describe the methods by which we allocate state appropriation to the colleges and universities. It concerns only state support. All tuition and fee revenue is collected and remains on the campus under the control of the presidents. The allocation process pays different amounts for different programs. More expensive programs receive more state funds, and less expensive programs receive less state funds. Campuses compete in this formula on cost efficiency and enrollment. The more efficient campuses have more funds to work with. The allocation of state appropriations to the campuses uses a formula that was approved by the board for use starting in 2002 and fully implemented in 2006. In 2000, when the board approved the formula, fully 40% of the system's total revenues were derived from state support and ran through the allocation process. With the loss of state support in the last 10 years, that percentage has fallen to 26% of our revenue. So a process that was really central to our colleges and universities 10 years ago, with the change in our revenue profile, has retreated in its importance. We have two principal sources of support, state appropriation and tuition. We do not have professional schools, we do not have major federal research funds, or a big foundation. Ours is a simple operation. 60% of our revenue is derived from either the state or tuition. Another 20% is from federal and state financial aid. Our allocation process addresses this appropriation and tuition revenue in two different ways. Tuition revenue is collected on the campuses and stays on the campuses. It doesn't flow into St. Paul and back out again. No tuition revenue is used to support the system office. Tuition revenue stays on the campus books, it's in the campus bank accounts, and it's in their budget entirely. The state aid flows through this process. So first, let me talk about the first box that you see on your graphic, $450 million in 2013. That is where the substantial portion of the state support was allocated. It concerns only credit-based instruction. In answer to a question that arose last, maybe 2 weeks ago, about customized training, there's approximately $9 million that flows through that first box for customized training and continuing education. And that amount is reported in the formula allocation to campuses that you see here. The formula uses a number of factors, including enrollment levels, the cost of each program, and national peer comparison data. Once the formula runs and a lump sum is arrived at, it's allocated to the campuses as a block grant, and the campuses have total discretion in how they spend the funds. The amount allocated per FYE can vary from a 2013 high of $3,839 to Pine Technical College to a low of $1,897 to Normandale Community College. The formula pays much more for a technical program with small class sizes and large equipment costs than it does for a liberal arts program with large class sizes and low equipment costs. For instance, the average state support for a carpentry program is $3,450 per FYE, while the average for lower division anthropology is $1,150. A substantial portion of the campus allocation is based on instruction and academic support costs. And these costs are built from the instructional cost study, which is in your binder. And I would really urge you to page through the instructional cost study. I think you'll find it full of really interesting information about how the college and universities manage their programs. Every credit-based course at every college and university is analyzed in terms of cost per FYE. We have standard coding and cost allocation methodologies across the schools and publish this analysis every year. It's on our website. It's reviewed at the department level by the deans and the academic leadership, as well as by the CFOs. Once all the components of the model are built, the allocation flows out to the campuses in a lump sum, and the presidents have complete discretion on how they use it.
Vice Chancellor, you said that there is no dispersion of what goes to the campus. So if a campus is in declining enrollment and it maintains the same level of programs while it's in declining enrollment, then campuses that are at least holding their own or have increased enrollment, tuition funds are not diverted from those campuses to a campus that has declining enrollment but still needs to maintain the program that it has before it. That does not occur.
Mr. Chair, there is no movement of tuition dollars from one campus to another. There hasn't been since very early post-merger. That went on in the state universities, I believe, and the community colleges prior to the merger, but post-merger we have eliminated that feature.
Then, Vice Chancellor, it would be critical for a campus to maintain enrollment since the tuition funding is based on enrollment, particularly as a result of the cuts. So the campus that would have to make some fairly difficult choices, would it not, on how to sustain those programs if it were in declining enrollment?
Mr. Chair, we expect campuses to balance their budget every year, and we have worked very hard through this allocation process to help explain what the reward system is for state appropriation. Enrollment matters, cost management matters, and comparisons with national peer data matters.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor, he gave a lot of information over the last 5 minutes. Thank you very much. Do you have that written down somewhere where we could review it and look at it so that...
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to put this into something that we can put in the package for tomorrow.
I think that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Certainly.
All right.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chancellor. Just moving back a little bit to the median debt levels rising much faster than tuition.
Yep.
As I look at this, the associate degree program has almost tripled, while the BA has been a little bit more stable. And can you speak to that at all?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, let me see if I can call on Mr. Schoniker, who's busy trying to find the right piece of paper.
Okay. Schoniker.
Representative Blowski, Representative Rosenthal. Part of what is happening with this trend over this period of time is this is the median debt for all graduates, those that borrowed, those that didn't. And so as the percentage of graduates who borrow increases, which is has been happening more rapidly at the associate level than the baccalaureate level, that increase, that median is appears to be increasing more rapidly because more graduates are borrowing. When we just look at the median for those that borrowed, the growth wouldn't be quite as precipitous, but the percentage of borrowing is going up.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a little bit more on that. You say the debt levels are rising faster than tuition. What is that extra burden?
Mr. Schoniker.
Representative Chair Blowski, Representative Rosenthal. The amount that students are able to borrow is determined through the financial aid process, and so it is not only the tuition and fees that they would pay or books and supplies that they would have to pay for, but there is a recognition of their living costs, room and board, typically some transportation allowance. So there's a total, what is characterized as a cost of attendance in the financial aid process that is the starting point for determining eligibility for loans. And then any grant aid would come in first, scholarships, and then students would be eligible for an amount of loans based on how much of their cost of attendance had not been covered by other sources or by an assumption of what their family would be contributing. Those costs, I suspect, have not been going up, but we suspect that one of the factors in this growth of borrowing is likely the recession, the experience that families have had, perhaps in not being able to support their students that are in college or university at the same levels. We see more of our part-time students working in order to support, to pay for their education, and the borrowing is one source that they're able to access in order to enable them to pursue their education.
Representative Swedinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of looking at your 18, that median debt level, looking, what would it be from a traditional, if we could break it down from traditional student to non-traditional student? You know, if you look, you kind of mentioned on it with the question talking about why is there increased debt, because it's a kind of a twofold, because one, if the parents lost one of their incomes, they would qualify for more loans, and so, but also if they lose a job, they're less able to help support their kids through their education. So it's kind of a two-prong approach to divergent numbers, but how would it be kind of, I was thinking kind of looking on an average where non-traditional students coming in where maybe they've already kind of pushed aside where parental support would kind of not have been there, where, you know, if they're a 22-year-old or 21-year-old, that relationship still may be there, but if a 30-year-old or 34-year-old, and how that would reflect in these numbers, that would be kind of a different look.
But Mr. Schoniker.
Chair Plowski, Representative Swedinski. I don't have the specifics on that, but in general, students who are older than 24 are considered independent students, so they're independent of their parents or their family income. And so that is a significant differentiating factor in terms of the amount of aid that is provided. Likely also impacts the borrowing, but I don't have specifics on that with
me. Okay. I don't know if it'd be possible to find something like that. Is there some place you could point me to look something like that up? Or
yeah, Mr. Shoniker?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Swedzinski, we can take a look at that and sort out the distinctions between independent and dependent students.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Swedzinski, if the Office of Fire Education is here, they may be able to help you too. So, Representative Fitzsimmons.
Mr. Chair and testifiers, you know, I'm curious of this, you know, one-third who are graduating without loan or maybe some that are on the very low debt level, and if you've done things that have looked into a profile of those students or a kind of a demographic makeup, or you know, what are those students doing? Are there lessons we can find in there on what are the factors that go into some of these students that are able to graduate with little to no, you know, debt, and what does that look like?
Mr. Shonick.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative, we can take a look at that as well. We have not done that analysis, but we certainly could, as part of this additional look at independent versus dependent, we can take a look at the those that did not borrow to see what sorts of characteristics they have.
Representative.
Thank you.
Mr. Shoniker, does the increase, if it exists, of the part-time student impact that, where they're not taking a full load, they're doing the best they can, but they're working or have a family or both?
Chair Pawlowski, certainly that's one of the strategies that we see among our students and that we hear about anecdotally, is that sort of strategy of enrolling part-time, working part-time or even full-time, and trying to pay for their cost of attendance out of current income. In order not to have to borrow.
Mr. Shoniker, but you don't have information directly related to that?
I don't have that with me today, Chair Pawlowski.
Mr. Shoniker, would you have it?
We could develop it.
All right. We would like to look at it. When we get to doing the budget, there are concerns over the growth of the part-time student and what's happened in that category over the recession. So, yes, we'd like to see it. Thank you. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure which testifier would best be able to answer this, but can you go back a little bit to the formula allocation to campuses? Was I correct in hearing that some of that formula is based on more expensive programs or more expensive classes?
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you'll find in the book here what we call the instructional cost study, and what that will show you is that absolutely the formula pays more for more expensive programs and less for less expensive programs, and we compare all the same programs across each college and have basically built a competitive environment where they compete on a cost per FYE for the same program. And you'll see in the materials, we pay much more for carpentry than we do for anthropology, and the result of that is that the standalone technical colleges, on average, have a much higher per FYE state appropriation than the standalone community colleges.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. King, is that also a little bit what goes into the appropriation request from the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you'll Vice see Chancellor. In our appropriation request from the state a request to help us with new program development, and that's the most direct connection. Otherwise, in the budget request, you'll see a request for support for a third of our compensation costs. If we were successful with that, that money would go right into the top of the, you know, if you think of the formula as being a funnel, it would go right in the top and it would spread out across all the colleges and universities without regard to program type the colleges and universities were delivering.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And okay, so I guess Ms. King, something I was noticing is some of those same programs that are more expensive. It seems to me it was also on the same list as the differential tuition programs. Am I correct in that assessment?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sure there's some overlap.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess how is that differential tuition assessed? Is it before the formula allocation, or does that come in afterwards to make up the difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Vice Chancellor.
The formula does not allocate tuition revenue. The tuition revenue at each college or university is taken out of the costs before the costs are compared, and that's how we adjust for different tuition revenues at different colleges and universities.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, just to clarify, then, that the decision based on the cost of the differential tuition is made before or after that formula allocation is taken into account?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not really sure how to answer that question. The thinking from a campus starts with what will it cost me to deliver this program? What are my resources to do it? A campus person could look into the cost study and see how much the formula pays for a particular program and then make a judgment about whether or not that was sufficient for them to deliver the program. But that's only concerning state dollars. Presidents make particular decisions about tuition dollars without any input from our office.
Representative Lee.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Grunhagen, did you have a question?
No.
All right,
this time.
Vice Chancellor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second major component of the allocation framework supports a label here, debt service, shared services, initiatives, et cetera. We gather up those costs that we have to pay for on behalf of the colleges and universities or on a system-wide basis, and we use state appropriation to do that. We have a debt service obligation that comes to the system as a result of the general obligation program. We have to pay for attorney general's costs. The legislature several years ago supported our request for enterprise technology funds. We pay for auditors. Those kinds of things come into this second allocation bucket. These funds do not flow out to the campuses. They stay in St. Paul and pay bills on behalf of all the campuses from St. Paul. The balance, the most substantial portion of this concerns debt service and enterprise technology. In 2012, our debt service obligation was $18 million, and we paid that, as we said, off the top. We took that $18 million off the top before we allocated state appropriation, and we also have in that allocation $20 million to run the system's enterprise technology platform. You heard a little bit about the energy, information technology platform last week, but let me just spend another second on it, if I might. We have a system, an information technology system that supports about 7 million unique users. We process about 30 million financial transactions annually. We support 2 million web page applications daily, and we show a peak of 220,000 logins on a daily basis. This is simply a gigantic integrated record system that maintains our accounting, payroll, student records, registration, transcripting, the online curriculum and learning management system, our space management system. It's a really just a tremendously large system. Nationally, the advice is that industries like ours should spend 4 to 5% of our annual revenue on enterprise technology, and we spend about 2%. So even though they're large numbers, they're large dollar amounts, they're large service numbers, From a national basis, it's well below the mean. Our IT environment really has two parts. Our colleges and universities typically operate student computer labs, campus email systems, support their instructional technologists who help them put instruction online. They support all the campus desktops, the campus telephone system, and they staff a help desk for campus employees. None of those costs are in the $20 million I mentioned. Those costs are all in campus budgets. The system enterprise technology budget supports the single accounting, payroll, student records, and learning management system for all of the colleges and universities. This group runs the statewide backbone, and you might remember last year we had a map that showed all of the pipes that run from St. Paul to all of the campuses. We maintain the pipes that DNR uses, that public safety uses, that many of our local counties use through their public safety systems. And this is done through two data centers with 300 servers. That's paid for in this middle tier, the middle $58 million, and is delivered in several sites around the state for the benefit of the whole system. Paid for with state support. The final portion of the allocation process concerns support for campuses funding the system office. The system office budget, as you heard last week, has declined 15% since 2006 and 24% since 2009. In 2012, the system office represents 2.2% of the system's total general fund revenue, a decline from its peak of 3% in 2009. Every two or three years, all of the presidents and their staff and the system office leadership go through a review of the services and capacities we have in the system office for campus support. Presidents talk to us about services they'd like us to add and services they'd like us to drop. And that process constantly tunes up what work we do for the campuses from the system office. And recalling that there's no tuition revenue in the system office budget, these services are all supported by state dollars. Fully 60% of the system office budget and 40% of the FTE are related to the information technology platform. The balance support a legal group, financial reporting team, academic program and planning, capital program delivery, internal audit, and labor management negotiators. It's noteworthy that the system office employment level has changed little from the date of the merger 18 years ago. We are now down 20 people from 1995. But it's also noteworthy that the work going on has changed substantially. The IT product portfolio that I've mentioned briefly didn't exist 18 years ago. We did not have 100,000 students taking online instruction. We did not have over $200 million in online payments processed annually, and we did not, of course, produce financial statements either at the system level or at the institution level. So the distribution of funds between these three boxes has changed some over the years. It depends on whether there's a legislative special that directs the money in a certain direction, whether there's a mix in services, but the process itself is referred to as the allocation framework. It's overseen by the presidents, and it's been reviewed here at the legislature on a couple of occasions, and, of course, is reviewed quite carefully by the board on an annual basis.
Vice Chancellor, Representative Carlson has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I want to go back to the debt service, that $18 million you referenced. Is that for the one-third share on some of the general obligation bonds? And if it is, where does the debt service for dormitories appear?
Vice Chair, Representative Carlson, the debt service that I'm concerned with here in this middle box is the 1/6 that the system pays on behalf of everyone, or it's the debt service associated with debt pre-1997 when the sharing language came from the legislature. The debt service paid for by the campuses for the GO program is not contained in this discussion. It's in the campus budgets. The debt service for the revenue fund projects is also not contained in this discussion because it's not a general fund obligation. That's contained in the revenue fund financial statements for each of the colleges and universities that participate in the revenue fund. This concerns just the general fund and just the debt service that is paid at the system level, either because it's pre-1997 and there was no sharing with the campuses, or it represents the 1/6 that the system, the system pays on behalf of all of the campuses.
Representative Carl.
Mr. Chairman, to drop down to the support for campuses from the system office, you said you were down 20 people since the merger or thereabouts.
Vice Chancellor,
the question that I have, do you have any people in the central office that are on loan from the campuses? As you know, I'm a former teacher. We used to refer to people like that in our central office as TOSAs. That was stood for Teachers on Special Assignment. And quite frankly, it was a way to give the perception that the central office, in the case of a large school district, was a bit smaller than it was in actuality. So are any of the people in the central office, because I hear from campuses that there is concern about the number of employees in the central office, and I'm not going to make a judgment on that other than my question is, how are you defining central office relative to any staff that may be on loan or temporary? Some of the TOSAs, by the way, were there for years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, what we reference in this analysis are the positions that are paid for with general fund dollars on the payroll in the system office. So if I can't think of anyone we have that's on loan from a campus, but if they're in the system office paid for with general fund dollars, they'd be counted in this number. We do on occasion create opportunities for campus folks or system office folks to apply for special projects, but that would be in this number. I'm thinking we have someone right now that's working in the system office off one of the campuses, but he's on our payroll and he's in this number. So I can't think of an occasion where under the current methodology we wouldn't capture those folks. If they're on the system office payroll in the general fund, they're in this number.
Representative Carlson.
Well, I think that answers it, Mr. Chairman. The only reason I ask that question is sometimes you can manipulate those numbers in various ways, and I'm not making that accusation other than I do know from my personal experience that that's been done in some of our large school districts.
Vice Chancellor King, I'm still looking at page 18 of the 2010 Legislative Auditor Report, which you say is incorrect. And in Legislative Auditor Report of 2010, this is where the Legislative Auditor makes the statement that prior to merger, you had a, depending on how you want to count it, 1981, 233, that was 1981, 223, in 1992 it was 233. Then there's a statement. A 2002 internal Minsky report said, in the course of the Chancellor's travels across Minnesota and his visits with legislators, business persons, and campus faculty, staff, and administrators, a fairly common sentiment had been that the office of the Chancellor had become too large to be efficient. Then the last sentence is, since 2002 report was issued, the number of system FTE grew from 318 in fiscal year 2002 to 417 in fiscal year 2009, or 385 if you exclude the 32 campus presidents. I know you disagree with this, and you said that this is incorrect. My problem is it's the legislative auditor, who does not have a reputation for arbitrarily printing figures. And I'm going to go back to where we were last Wednesday just for a second. We have the University of Minnesota that apparently has difficulty counting administrators to the point where it appears in the Wall Street Journal. We have you saying that the legislative auditor is incorrect, and yet I'm not convinced that either the legislative auditor or the Wall Street Journal is incorrect on the fact that there is simply too much administration in either Minsky or the University of Minnesota. So in the course of these hearings, and certainly when we proceed with further budgets into the next cycle, there's going to have to be a revisiting on how you count the numbers, who they are, and more importantly, what they do. And I think to the point that was raised here, just what exactly do you get for that level of administration? How does that improve the system? Because if we're looking at, you can say these tuition increases were somehow not out of line. By anyone's justification, what's happened with this tuition has been horrific. We have students here today from Mankato and Moorhead, and I hope they're listening closely to what's happening here. They're the ones that are going to have to pay the price and are paying the price. Even your medium debt is abhorrent. So there's something that has to be adjusted in higher ed. The responsibility, of course, is we cut. Yes, yes, we did cut. And it, particularly with Minskew, there was no complaint. None. You said you could handle it. And the handling is being done by the students that are sitting here today. So as we proceed, there's going to have to be an ongoing evaluation of administration, how much, how beneficial, where they are, and then just exactly how much of a central office do you need to run the show. With that, any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Vice Chancellor, you said that there were 100,000 online students. What do you expect that number to be in terms of your planning over the next 2 to 5 years, or however you go about your planning, and what impact will that have on your budget?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have seen really substantial growth in that number in the last 5 years. One of the changes that's happening is that online is becoming less of a pure distinction and more of a hybrid distinction, which is why we have 7 million unique users in our information system and 200,000 logons a day. It's more and more often the case that a course would be delivered with both classroom and online experience. And that's why the projection here has been outrunning our expectations every year. More faculty are putting more of their coursework online as part of their teaching in the classroom, and we're using more and more instructional technology. So from a projection standpoint, we don't really project at a pure online basis. We project much more growth in what we call the hybrid category.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, so then does it have an impact on the budget as far as costing more or reducing costs for students? What's the impact in terms of the real-life finances to students, or is there, you don't see any change?
Vice Chancellor.
Representative Johnson, it does impact the budget. It impacts it in a couple of ways. We have development costs, which are extraordinary costs on an ongoing basis. And I mentioned when we talk about where technology costs occur, at the campus level, campuses pay faculty to step out of the classroom and develop content to be put online. So that's a cost that is added to the overall budget. Per course or per class basis, the costs are about the same because there's still faculty involved, there's still interaction with faculty involved. On a pricing basis, we have priced online higher on a per credit basis than in the classroom instruction, but that's coming down, and we're moving to a parity rate between in the classroom and completely online. So I would expect that over time we'd see improvement in it from an efficiency standpoint, and we have seen that improvement.
Further question, Representative Johnson, is that ended?
Yes, thank you.
All right, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Leaving the allocation framework then, if members are ready to do that, I will turn to the budgeting process and talk some more about our internal decision-making and planning practices. We are really always in a budget mode We're running two operating budget processes every year. On the one hand, we have college and universities doing their annual operating budget, and then the entire system does a biennial budget request one year and a capital budget request in the opposing year. For the legislative budget request, the Chancellor started out by having discussions with the statewide student associations, with the faculty and staff meet and confer groups, and at the Leadership Council level, which is our group of 32 presidents. These discussions started in the spring of 2012, continued into the late fall prior to the board's adoption of the legislative request and the recommended package that was submitted to the executive branch. We've included a timeline of those discussions in our packet of additional materials that we'll have to you tomorrow. The Leadership Council, with all 32 presidents, also had several discussions about some of the key planning assumptions. Now imagine these are 32 presidents. They have 17,000 employees. They're located in 50 communities around the state, and they all come together as a group and talk with each other about their enrollment forecast, about what's happening with their materials inflation, what are they thinking about tuition and fee differences from one year to the next, what are their student consultations telling them, what's going on with labor negotiations, what's going on with health insurance costs, where are they with the strategic plan. All of those conversations happen both at the campus level and in a peer group level at the Leadership Council. For the annual operating budget discussion, the Chancellor has similar discussions with all of the statewide groups, whether it's the faculty and staff labor associations or the student associations, conversations with the board, and with the presidents. All that comes together and moves through the process you see on the timeline here from June to September, October, and then December. For the biennial budget request, the timeline has us submitting in November. For the operating budget request, the annual operating budget request, all these conversations would feed into a board discussion in the spring for board action in the April, May, June horizon. The presidents make all their own budget decisions. There are no constraints or limitations placed upon them by the board, by the chancellor, or by my office. They each establish their own strategic initiatives. They pick the programs they want to grow and retire. They choose their equipment plans, their technology investments, and otherwise run their institutions. Now, I say no constraints, but just know that they're expected to balance their budget, and they're expected to maintain financial integrity from one year to the next in their institution. The process runs almost continuously between the operating budget and the capital budget.
Vice Chancellor, before you leave this goes back to a conversation we had last Wednesday, particularly the September 2013. After meeting with almost all of these groups, except for the presidents, and I've met with them, but I pretty much know their answer, their response was they had no direct input at the campus level or at any other level with the creation of this budget. So I'm going to ask you, when the budget was done and it was presented to the Board of Trustees, this is in October of 2013, the interfaculty organization wanted to have some input and presented to the trustees their suggestions for the budget. Can you tell me how that budget proposal from the interfaculty organization was received and integrated into the Minsky budget?
Mr. Chair, there was communication on September 7th between the Chancellor and the interfaculty organization, preliminary discussions, what are we thinking, how should we come at the budget discussion. Those conversations continued as late as November 29th before there was a submission to the board. We did have communication with all of the labor unions. We solicited their input. We received their input. And I think what we have here is an occasion where their input was not entirely adopted.
Yes, I believe one of your trustees characterized it this way, tribalism. I'm still trying to figure out what that means. but I don't know how the interfaculty organization could be considered tribalistic. You say communication. That doesn't necessarily mean input. When I meet with them, I don't have a MNSCU administrator. I meet with them sans MNSCU administration. It's interesting that when you do that, and they say that they had no input directly or indirectly, and then you give me this bullet point list, there's a contradiction. Your budgets, I think, over the last few years reflect that, that your budgets were conceived up here, and I think they were conceived in a fashion as to whatever you could sell whoever's on the Hill this legislative session. And I think the fault is what's happened to tuition and debt and other things. But we'll go back. We'll have testimony on it when you do your budget request. I think you communicate by telling them what to do. And I know that because I was in a meeting at Winona State about 2 weeks after the first indication was they had no communication. I was with administrators in the president's office. One of the administrators had to leave because at 2 o'clock there was going to be a conference call from MNSCU Central explaining the MNSCU budget to them. And the individual said, oops, I guess I shouldn't have mentioned that. I said, no, that's exactly what we should know, that the budget is top-down, driven by the central office and the president, and that there is no input from the campuses. Now, that's my impression of how this budget is put together after talking to the groups without MNSCU representation. Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, I can't comment on that. It's your impression, not ours.
Yeah, it is, after meeting with the groups that are responsible. All right, proceed.
All right, then.
Representative Winkler.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't know we were ready to move on. Ms. King, when the Chancellor was here, most of the time, actually, I think on every occasion, he talked about programming cuts and sort of a natural pruning process for programs that become obsolete or unpopular or whatever, and that was a substantial share of the cost reduction. In this narrative of the budget development, I don't really see that called out in specific. I mean, it's sort of implicit in the kind of descriptions you have here, but can you describe in greater detail how campus presidents formulate programmatic changes as a part of their budget and how you, as a central office, consider the trade-offs in their budget requests based on program cuts versus cost?
Vice Chancellor.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler. The planning process for us is about 48 months long, and so the campuses run a continuous program review and evaluation process every year, and have discipline through their academic deans and department heads in consultation with their HR directors and their CFOs. And I think we talked a little bit about this when we were last together. There is a methodology for evaluating programs from an efficiency and an effectiveness standpoint. That methodology is always running. Alongside of that is the president's strategic planning process, which is also always running. And alongside that is the financial outlook. When those three things come together, the president has some judgment to make about what their program capacity is from one year to the next. And they have to make that judgment out 24 to 36 months into the future because of our requirements to complete programs and because of the very long line we have on staff changes. So that judgment gets made. It gets folded into the president's annual operating budget. And on a program-by-program basis, there's very little interaction between the chancellor and the president. The chancellor's conversation with the president concerns the president's execution on the board's strategic framework and how the president chooses to do that from program to program really is left to the president's leadership. We don't approve program additions or closures in the system office. There's a network of academic officers around the state that run a sort of a review and comment process. But the presidents have substantial discretion over program additions and closures. Because we have such a long lead time from a cost structure standpoint, we really expect presidents and their staff to be regularly running all of these analyses. We expect academic quality, we expect student services, and we expect financial integrity. From that, the presidents have challenges and solutions that they have to work every year.
Mr. Chair, Ms. King, let me just see if I can understand it more simply. And, you know, maybe the legislature's view of the world is incorrect or misguided, but it seems to me that if you're making a budget request, you're deciding how much you're going to spend and what you're going to buy. And so are you saying that at the as MNSCU is forming its budget request to the legislature, the chancellor's office, the central office, doesn't necessarily know what the trade-offs are at the campus level for various levels of funding from the state and various levels of tuition, and that basically there's kind of a conversation about a dollar amount between the central office and the president, and the central office doesn't really is not involved in what that dollar amount might buy?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, you'll find in your binder 6 years' worth of narrative illustration of the trade-offs that happen on a college-by-college basis. And we are involved in that. We compile that report. We know a lot about it. But at the program level, at the course level, that's the president's leadership job.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. King, so MNSCU's central office is aware over time of what the decisions are, and you track it, but you're not necessarily reacting to a budget request from a campus based on what the impact on programming will be at that campus. You're essentially giving them a pot of money and they make the decision. You're not helping them decide that this particular allocation should be larger because we have these program needs?
Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, you have come to the tension we have in our environment. The allocation framework that we've just spent a little bit of time talking about is highly sensitive to enrollment changes and to cost management. But it expresses no bias toward one kind of program or another. That bias comes through in the president's strategic planning and in their annual performance evaluation with the chancellor. So the allocation process doesn't pick winners and losers from a program standpoint because we're just too diverse. It picks winners and losers based on efficiency and enrollment. The leadership discussion that happens between the chancellor and the president focuses on where we have program needs, where the workforce requirements are, what's come up through the consultation process, through the listening sessions. So as programs are being added or deleted, that conversation's happening separate from the allocation discussion because the tail on the allocation discussion is too long.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. King, as I hear that, you're basically dividing up the budget pool according to a four-year tail, and then on an annual basis, there's a leadership discussion about what that allocation is actually going to be buying in terms of programming. You're not sort of lining up your budget allocation in 1 year based on the program need for that year.
Vice
Mr.
Chancellor.
Chair, Representative Winkler, recall that we have 3,000 programs and 400,000 students, which is why we're such really devoted multi-year planners. We're constantly looking forward to see what program requirements, what we hear from our industry partners, what's happening in the marketplace, but we are we're looking forward in a way that recognizes that we have a large ship behind us that we're steering.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. King, I'm frankly not sure I have any more knowledge than I did when I started the questions. not I just think it's hard to translate maybe, but when I'm making a budget decision here, I'm looking at how much we spend and what we are going to get, and you have to evaluate what the, you know, what if it's worth spending more on a particular program or not spending as much on a particular program, or if the total needs are greater, so we need to spend more, and that drives the budget that we look at. From what I'm, is it the takeaway that I'm getting from Minsky is you do multi-year budget planning, and then you sort of tailor the program that is offered every year based on the money that is on the table as a product of your multi-year budget planning?
Vice Chancellor
Chair,
King.
Representative Winkler, this conversation, I think, is disadvantaged by not having had our budget presentation. Because I think when you hear our budget presentation, what you will hear is that it was built very consciously around what we heard from the campuses and the communities about needs, whether it was the leveraged equipment program or the internship program or the need to Representative Johnson's question, to invest in technology improvements in the classroom. So I think the connection's there, but we're coming at the conversation maybe only with half the information.
But Vice Chancellor King, the budget that's before us is your current budget, and that was built the same way, correct? You should be able to explain both.
Mr. Chair, I was understanding the question to have to do with the biennial budget request.
Vice Chancellor King, I think the question applies to both. We're looking at your current budget, what you are expending right now. There may be a difference in your budget request, but your current budget should also reflect exactly what Representative Winkler is asking questions about, should it not? Or are we looking at two separate ways of putting a budget together? And I'm going to go back to my first observation. I think the budget requests that you come to the legislature with are simply what you can sell to us at any given legislative session. Before us is your current budget. I would hope that there would be an identical pattern of behavior in both. Well, I wouldn't hope that, considering what I know about your current budget request. But his question should apply to both.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, as regards annual operating budget planning, the campuses undertake discussions on campus as to what they need in their community, what's going on with their demand, what their class size trends are looking like. They talk at the Leadership Council about emerging trends in their region or across the state. They talk with the Chancellor about the strategic objectives that we have in the 12 months ahead of us, and then they make their budget decisions. Once they complete their budget decisions, the year is over. They've got performance results to report on. They come in and see the Chancellor, and they have a conversation about correcting course from one year to the next. I think it is analogous. The difference between the operating budget and the biennial budget request is the biennial budget request concerns the state appropriation and a 24-month horizon. The operating budget concerns both state appropriations as well, but at a 12-month horizon.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. King, I guess what I'm trying to understand is, does your biennial budget request to the legislature reflect the requests of local campuses for program changes directly?
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, I think you would find, Representative Winkler, that the proposals in the biennial budget request are directly tied to what the campuses tell us their communities interested in.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. King, I'm not so much interested in sort of the add-on, bolt-on type programs like the equipment. I'm talking more about what classes are offered, how big the sections are, those kinds of things.
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, the place where that would show up most directly would be in the efficiency proposal that we have as part of our solution, with $44 million of campus reallocations, whether it's class size changes or course program closures or equipment budget changes. That's how that is captured in the budget request. And the presidents would have discretion on how to do it.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vice Chancellor King, for your testimony. And, you know, I'm kind of a one- and two-page summary type person. And what I mean by that is, you know, as I'm listening to this discussion, there's just a couple things that come to mind. One is your student enrollment has gone up, and obviously that should bring additional money into the campuses, okay, overall. And if you take the student enrollment additional plus if you subtract your from tuition, your decrease in state funding, if you were doing a real good job, you should only see a tuition increase equal to the percentage of the decrease of state subsidy to the institutions in the last few years. If you were doing extremely good job, you'd actually see the increase in tuition less than the decrease as a percentage of state funding. So in order to assess this, and it seems like the administration thing has been a bone of contention, I would just throw this comment out and you tell me if it's doable or not. I just like a one or two page summary where you show your growth of enrollment, okay, and I know what's in here, and then you show over the last three bienniums the increase in salary and benefits plus bonus for administrators who got bonuses and then ones who didn't, and compare that to faculty, what type of increases they had, and finally any other cost that you would believe pertinent that has contributed to the increase in tuition. I think those things could be put on one or two pages, and then you could also list the decrease in administrators or faculties, decrease or increase in the numbers, and to me that would give me a picture of where the cost drivers are in relationship to the rising tuition versus the lower state subsidy. Did I make myself clear, or do you understand what I'm saying?
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me try a couple of things and then see if that responds to you. And this was in an earlier slide deck, so it's in your materials as well. We know that state support per FYE has declined 45% since 2000. We know that between 2006 and 2012, we had a $325 million challenge, including the state reduction, our inflation costs, and we know that we used tuition to solve 42% of that challenge. 58% of it was solved through reallocations, budget cuts, improved program operations. Only 42%. Roughly half of the challenge was solved with tuition. During that same period, our headcount increased by 50,000 students, and our spending on instructional costs, things like administration, the president's office, the business office, the technology office, went down from 12.4% to 11.7%. The bonuses that we've had some conversation around in this room in the last couple of weeks represent less than half of 1% of our payroll costs, and our administrators are 500 out of 17,000 employees. So there's maybe a couple of things, and we've been taking notes here, and we'll make sure we captured the rest of what you asked for, and we'll provide it for you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just, you know, some type of summary page where you can look at all that information side by side, and rather than, you know, tab by tab.
Certainly.
So that it's just like a two-page summary, if that's not too difficult to do. And it just helps with getting your mind around the financial workings of MNSCU. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to remind everyone that the intent of doing the budget overviews in this way was to try to get us to understand the current budgets of the University of Minnesota and MNSCU, so that when you do your budget request, we can understand the basis for that request and how it would impact your current budget. That was the intent, and I had hoped we would make it ongoing from this point forward in higher education. Okay, proceed, Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, if we're ready to leave the budgeting discussion, I would turn us then to a discussion about unexpended balances. And this you'll find in tab 12 of your materials. What you see on the graph or on the screen there illustrates the balances we had at the system level, meaning the whole enterprise, at the end of fiscal 12. They're composed of general fund reserves, special revenue funds, enterprise funds, restricted expendable bond covenants, restricted expendable other, and general fund, unrestricted. Our colleges and universities have ended every fiscal year between 2006 and 2012 within 2% of revenues and expenses. Our board's been very firm on financial management discipline, and year-end balances are part of that discipline. Their presence gives the colleges and universities the tremendous capacity to absorb shocks to their budget. We were spending fund balances from 2006 to 2009 as we adjusted to state reductions, and in 2010 to 2012, we've added slightly to fund balances. So they're really a shock absorber from a budgeting standpoint. The restricted expendable balances represent 22% of our total fund balance, and these relate to the revenue fund and external grants. The revenue fund was recently rated by Moody's and Standard & Poor's in anticipation of an upcoming, now completed bond sale, and received a rate of AA2 and AA-. A better rating on revenue fund sales leads to lower interest costs, which in turn leads to lower costs to students. And that line can be drawn directly from the presence of fund balances to the rating.
Vice Chancellor King, I want to stay on the full page you're on in the packet where it says the Higher Learning Commission's accreditation standards require your appropriate reserve levels. And I can understand the bonding part of it. What's the minimum requirement by the Higher Learning Commission? How low can you go?
Mr. Chair, the Higher Learning Commission has adopted something called the Composite Financial Index, and you have in your materials the score. I think the next page in your book is the index for each of our schools. If a college or university falls below 1.0 in the index, they will get review by the Higher Learning Commission. And are required to undergo a workout plan with the Higher Learning Commission. Moody's recently released a report on the outlook for higher education in the nation and had a generally negative outlook. And likewise, the Higher Learning Commission has doubled the number of sanctions that they've issued in their region in the last year. And that has to do in part with financial condition for the colleges and universities. It's not possible to say that at the primary reserve level there's an absolute, because their analytical tool is the sum of four different measures. We have at the system level adopted as a matter of policy a goal that the primary reserve be strong enough to insulate the rest of the analytic from shocks that come from the capital budget. So regrettably, Mr. Chair, there's not one single answer.
Right.
This is like grading on the curve.
So what's the penalty if you go below that?
The penalty from the Higher Learning Commission is that you lose your accreditation and you lose your access to federal financial aid and you close your doors.
Were there states in the Great Recession that had dipped below it with their educational institutions and lost their accreditation, or did the Higher Learning Commission say we're in the worst economic crisis since the Depression and maybe we should adjust?
Mr. Chair, there are community colleges in California that are under sanction and at risk of losing their accreditation. They're not part of the Higher Learning Commission's region because the Higher Learning Commission is the middle states. But there are, yes, there are schools that have closed, and we know that their attention has doubled in the last year with no softening of this guideline.
And I'm going to go to the chart on 12.2. This is the one I requested. The comparison of the reserves for the state and then for Minsky, particularly the years 2009 to 2011, where the state was at zero and you actually increased your reserves during that time. And this goes to the question that Representative Grunhagen and others have raised dealing with the amount of tuition that was being raised. So what's the explanation for the reserves going up when we had none?
Mr. Chair, what you see here is an expression of reserves in the general fund, and they amount to, on average, 2 payroll cycles. So when we talk about 6% in the general fund, what we're really talking about is 1.5 to 2.5 payroll cycles. Recall that the state was in its shutdown negotiations several years ago. Our access to these funds is what enabled us to avoid having to kick kids out of the dorms. It enabled us to avoid having to do a financial exigency shutdown with instant emergency layoffs.
But Vice Chancellor, you were exempt from the shutdown, were you not?
Mr. Chair, we were exempt from the shutdown because we had these reserves that we could use to maintain operations. So the reason that you see these go up from 8 to 9 and or from 9 to 10, I think this is a matter of $4 or $5 million.
Well, Vice Chancellor King, I recall that in the first shutdown we'd already passed the higher ed bill, so it was off the table as far as the shutdown was concerned.
That's correct.
And then an exemption was given during the second shutdown.
Mr. Chair, the second time around, we engaged in discussions with the governor's office and the governor's lawyers about whether the statute was clear enough. They concluded it was clear enough to let us out of it. The next year we came back, and with the help of this body, we corrected the statute to be clear that because we have access to these reserves, we are excused from the shutdown.
Representative Nordis had a question. And
Real quick one. I was just noticing on this chart on 12-1, my college in my community, and the rating went from 3.37 in 11 to 1.95 in 12. What would cause a drop of that size?
Vice Chancellor King, any
idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nornes, typically what causes a movement that big is the effects in this measurement of capital investments. But I would be very happy to look into it.
Sure.
and give you a more complete answer.
Okay.
But that's typically what, and that's why we are using the primary reserve as sort of a cushion in this arithmetic, because the capital investment rate has a big impact on it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And that we can't control as well.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. King, the University of Minnesota uses its unexpended funds as liquidity necessary to maintain its bond funding. I assume that Minsky does the same thing. My calculation is that at the chart that you provided us, you've got about 128 days of expenses in cash. The university is 126. The university's credit rating is a little better than yours. Can you just confirm that what I said is largely true and explain why there might be a difference in credit rating from Moody's?
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, the liquidity test is a little different in our environment because at this juncture we have $525 million, I believe, that the state has borrowed from us to cash flow state government, which they don't do from the University of Minnesota. So it gives us a different dynamic. As far as credit rating is concerned, I think that the university's rating is substantially influenced by the relationship they have with state government around the football stadium and the academic health investments with the appropriation bonds or the appropriation for debt service. They have a much larger balance sheet than we do, but they also have fairly strong reliance on federal investments through the National Institutes of Health that we don't have on our balance sheet at all. So I would urge you to ask them that question. I'm not a close student of their financial profile. I thought we had the same rating, so it must have changed recently.
Representative Winkler, we're running close to the time.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ms. King, I may be wrong. The university presented a AA1. I think you said AA2 or AA-.
Yeah.
So there's a little difference.
All right, members, we're going to pick it up right here on Wednesday, and I want to return to the reserves and how they're used and when and if they're used. Representative Dorrault, you have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that the minutes of February 20th be approved.
Representative Dorrault moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.